Hello, and welcome to Benyo Chats. If you're curious about the world, this show is for you. How did so much of the world become rich? On this episode, I speak to Mark Koyama. Mark is an economic historian who has co-written a book describing the major intersection forces behind modern industrialization, including geography, energy, culture, institutions, democracy, technology, and more, and how any single factor is not the whole answer. Hope you enjoy the show. Please like and subscribe as it helps others find the podcast. Be well. Hey, everyone. I'm super excited to be speaking to Mark Koyama. Mark researches comparative national state economic development and also the rise of religious tolerance. His 2019 co-authored book with Noel Johnson is Persecution and Toleration, The Long Road to Religious Freedom. And his 2022 book is on How the World Became Rich, co-authored with Jared Rubin. Mark, welcome.
Thanks, Ben. Great to be here.
So first up, why do you think it has taken economists and historians so long to form central views on how we have become rich? Is it simply that historic data has been hard to reconstruct, or is it to do with the complexity of the interactions between these main various factors? We seem to have been slightly slow to really understand the causes of progress, and in fact, some of them are still a little bit contested.
Great. So I think there are two elements to this. So one element is the one you mentioned briefly, which is the quality of the historical data. So even as recently as, you know, the 1980s, 1990s, there are great books on the origins of economic growth historically. These are books, you know, I've learned a lot from Eric Jones's European Miracle, Birdsell and Rosenberg have a book on the origins of economic growth. So there were great books, but those were not really informed by very accurate estimates of per capita GDP in the past, and not informed by real wage data, not informed by kind of the data on heights. So there has been a revolution pioneered by other economic historians in terms of how much we know, like in terms of quantifying economic history. So to give one concrete example, Angus Madison was a pioneer of historical GDP data, and you'll see a lot of books quote Madison's numbers, but actually Madison's original numbers were quite vague and really guesstimates. And it's really in the last kind of 10 years that people have created, I think, much more credible estimates, other scholars building on Angus Madison. So that's part of it. There's another part of it, which is sometimes the way I think science and even social science progresses is that initially we have quite a good, early on, we might have quite a good understanding of the topic, but using methods which are quite kind of ad hoc or subject to criticism. And over time, what scientists and social scientists try to do is refine our methods. But as we refine our methods, we have to throw out a lot of what we previously knew. So Paul Krugman has a famous essay on development economics about this, where he compares it to a map of Africa. So before the explorations of the 19th century, people didn't really know what was going on in the interior of Africa. So, but they had a vague idea where rivers were and where the mountain ranges were. But they also thought there were monsters and places and unknown regions. But as we refined our knowledge of maps, we got rid of the stuff we didn't know for certain. And actually, we lost knowledge. We forgot about certain rivers and where certain places were because we only wanted to rely on scientific evidence. And so I think in economics and economic history, there's something of the same development. So Adam Smith and John Stuart Mill actually understood quite a lot about economic progress and economic development relatively. And actually, with the formalization of economics in the post-World War II period, we actually got rid of a lot of insights about institutions, about culture, and so on, because we wanted a more rigorous framework. So we wanted the solo model. And now what the research, I think, in the past 20 years has done is relearn some of those lessons.
So it really does seem that we've had a little bit of a step change in the kind of history and the science here. I was kind of wondering, maybe stepping forward before moving back, if we think of becoming wealthy as a form of progress, what do you think this history teaches us on where we might go next? Because you lay out in the book strong arguments for the intersection of several prerequisites, such as infrastructure, institutions, culture, geography, represented democracy of sorts, energy. Do you think these same factors will broadly apply to, for example, poor parts of Africa or developing nations? Even a country specifics will vary. Or do you think it's so kind of complex and nuanced that those individual factors will always vary depending on the locale and where we're thinking about?
So the lesson of Alexander Gershenkwan was that the path followed by later industrializers is different to the path followed by the early industrializers. So we can definitely see that. Even in the poorest parts of the world, people today have access to cell phones and the internet, which obviously, equivalently poor countries didn't have in the past. So you can think about jumping over what were previously important steps along the road to getting rich. One of the big challenges, I'm not a prognosticator. I don't think I'm like a super forecaster. So, but what I would say is one of the big one of the main routes to getting rich in the last 150 years roughly has been manufacturing. So that's a route pioneered by Britain, by the United States, by countries like Japan, by China, right? And often, you move through the value chain from lower value to value-added manufacturing goods like textiles, and up the value chain to more sophisticated products. One of the issues in the past 30 years has been that other countries, China had such a cost advantage, but other countries, say in sub-Saharan Africa, one other parts of the world, struggled to get onto the ladder even. And so that factoring route is difficult. Now wages in China have started to increase, so it's higher in China. So there's a possibility for other hubs to emerge for low-cost manufacturing. Perhaps you could say Bangladesh is already doing that. But the broad principles still seem to apply. So we're trying to articulate some principles about institutions and culture. And also when we talk about infrastructure, we're talking about infrastructure which supports kind of markets and trades. So I think those broad lessons still apply. But yeah, as you suggest, it's nuanced in the sense that how it applies is different in each case. And that's why the historical record is rich. It's why development economics is complicated. And it's why people can make fools of themselves with too strong predictions.
Great. And then maybe again, just before skipping backwards, I'd be interested if you had a view on the richer nations themselves. So there's a lot of talk in, say, the UK or the US or many of the richer nations about how productivity may be more diminished recently and how we should be aiming for more growth or more productivity. And I'd be interested if you had a view whether some of those same factors, so new institutions, a kind of building culture or innovation culture, anything to do with infrastructure, do those lessons of history still apply to potentially getting some of this better, because there's debates on supply side progressiveness or whether we've got too many regulations, or whether, like you say, once you've industrialized, you're kind of into uncharted territory and the lessons of history may not hold.
So when it comes to current policy advice, so I think I we don't talk about this in a book, this is because we deal with things historically, but I think in the country of UK and many parts of the US, planning and housing are the biggest constraints. So I really subscribe to the circle housing theory of Evering, where housing is the high price of housing, which is constrained largely by planning restrictions. It's a big problem in terms of getting people to productive areas. So you need to get young workers and ambitious workers and innovative workers to cluster in places like San Francisco or indeed London. And if they can't do so, if it's very costly to do so, that's a big drag on productivity. And I think allowing people to match, so allowing people to move to locations where their particular skills are demanded is crucial. And so that's critical. Housing wasn't a central issue in the pre-modern period because it was largely unregulated. So London became a monster. It became a ginormous city fairly early on, like in the 17th century already. And there was no regulation whatsoever. People lived in horrific conditions, and there was a lot of overcrowding, a lot of negative externalities, a lot of slum housing. And that was obviously bad, but it was also good because it allowed productive, ambitious people to come together and work together. And you see similar clusters in the Industrial Revolution in the north of England. And I think actually in British economic history, the last major episode of housing building was in the 1930s. And that was critical in getting Britain out of the Great Depression. It's a lesson we often miss because our understanding of the Great Depression is kind of totally biased by what happened in the United States. But in Britain, housing is crucial in getting people out of the Great Depression. So I think that's what I would emphasize in terms of most important thing that I can currently think of in the modern world. I'd also say that in general, adapting our institutions for the new productive technologies is important. So this rise of intangible economy and having the right institutions which are appropriate for that. So I kind of sometimes feel that copyright and intellectual property right laws are not really best suited to fit the current technological environment we live in.
Very good. So that's exactly what Anton Howells said, who was on the podcast a few minutes ago on the institution side on copyright and patents. And actually, Stian Westlake, who was also on the podcast recently, has said a lot about new institutions, particularly for the intangible economy, but for other things, or new bits of old institutions. But I think your housing point is really interesting.
Yeah. I didn't know either of them had been on the podcast, but I know both of them. So, yeah, we share similar ideas, I think.
So it's good. You have not as yet contradicted either of them, at least on the forward-looking part. That housing point is really interesting because it's so contested, because I would say there's probably a broad consensus in the UK amongst economic or even economic planning people that if you could build a lot on the greenbelt, which they don't think is very valuable land, it would be enormously beneficial in economic terms. But the political economy, at least people reading of the political economy, hasn't seemed to have made it happen, which seems to be a like little microcosm for a lot of these things. So we'll see where that goes. Although there's some signs actually just today in September, the UK is going to try and do something about that with the new government. So maybe then skipping back to your book, why I really liked it, or if I got the reading of it right, is you seem to be arguing with your co-author that it was the intersection of so many of these prerequisites which was really important. So it's not just institutions and infrastructure, it's not just coal in Newcastle, it was not just a kind of parliamentary representative democracy or your geography, it's the fact that you had brought all of those components together. Am I right in reading that as a central kind of argument of your book? And then I would add on top of that, you're quite careful to lay out kind of the median sort of theories about where all of this literature is and make the intersectionality of it all. Would you yourself weight any one or two of those factors, or maybe some of that intersectionality perhaps different from where the median literature is?
Complicated question. So from a scientific perspective, in some sense what we do, like a natural science perspective, in some sense what we do, you could say, is not fully satisfying, because if you want to propose a theory of economic growth, you want it to be parsimonious, and you want to kind of like focus on a few factors. And so that's what some people tend to do, because I think it's a habit we have from, you know, if we've studied like the harder sciences. But what we feel is important here is that we're not articulating theory of growth. We're documenting how the Industrial Revolution, how modern economic growth began. And so then it's important to be broad-minded about the causes, and it's important to give a full coverage and give equal weight to certain views. And my positions on this are open to debate and change. And I think there's a lot of room for allowing for multiple channels of causation. So to be clear, for example, there's some scholars who really emphasize the energy, the role of the energy transition. So the move from an organic economy to a mineral-based economy, particularly the coal. So they'll say coal is central to the British Industrial Revolution. And those who push back will say, look, like John McKay, Britain didn't have to have a coal, it could have imported energy. And even if there hadn't been coal, there were enough incentives to utilize other energy sources, and maybe growth would have been different or slower, but there still would have been something that we would recognize as the Industrial Revolution, even without coal. And so I tend, not to, in my own reading of this, not to overestimate the role of say, coal or other productive technologies, but I'm aware of you know, ongoing research. There's a paper by Kevin O'Rourke and co-authors, I think, which is showing a correlation between coal and city growth. So coal might play 5%, 6%, 7% contribution. That's not trivial, but it's not all of the story. Another example is the role of slavery in the Caribbean in the British economy in the 18th century. So in our book, we review this hypothesis, which is associated with Eric Williams, but we kind of come down on the side of the skeptics because we didn't see evidence at the time we were writing of strong linkages between the sugar nexus. And so the British colonies in the Caribbean, based on slavery, basically enriching a lot of plantation holders, and they're making some people rich. But we didn't think there was a lot of evidence for links between what they were doing and then industrialization later. So we downplayed it. Now there's a new NBER working paper by Joachim Voth and Stephen Redding arguing that that there is evidence for this link. And so, you know, but it turns out if you read that paper, and they say this is support for the Williams hypothesis. But if you find this paper, even in this paper, they find the statistical link between slave wealth, basically, and like local levels of manufacturing. But even on this paper, the effects are actually small. So I think that we wanted to present an account which we thought was fair to all the literature, was as up to date as we could possibly make it, given when we were writing, and that which we'd be happy with in 10 or 15 years as people do more papers and more studies. And so we're willing to adjust things on the margin, and we do think it's a multi-causal process. So there's no single factor that was critical. You could imagine the Industrial Revolution happening a little bit later, or a little bit slower, or a little bit faster, minus or adding some of these factors. So none of these factors to me is super decisive. And you can imagine missing, if England had missed several of the factors that we identify as important, you could imagine industrialization not happening. You could imagine 17th and 18th century Britain as a comparatively rich commercial trading society, but one which doesn't produce an industrial revolution.
Great. Oh, that brings up so many thoughts. So I would reiterate, that means you think there's no one factor, for instance, which would make even 20 or 30% of, you know, or the roots of getting rich, because it's unlikely to be one decisive factor. That's still a multifactorial thing. And maybe we'll go through some of them about how you potentially weight it.
Yeah, if anything's critical, it's for science in terms of preventing the Industrial Revolution from petering out. So if any one thing is critical, you take away the scientific revolution and the connection between scientists and engineers, then you start to think that maybe the first Industrial Revolution still could have happened, because many of the inventions like the spinning jenny didn't depend on science. But then you get stuck there, basically.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And maybe skipping back, actually, this is kind of a question from Anton Howes, which is, so why do you think then some older civilizations like the Romans or the Greeks or the Chinese, was it that science part, or was there something else which meant that they couldn't sustain their industrial revolution? And maybe you can go one skip further. And if you think about between Britain and Holland, which you cover in the book, that you kind of think that Britain really did sustain it and the Dutch didn't quite make it in the kind of like half mini age before that. At least that's what I get of your reading of the literature.
Yeah, certainly. So this is a longstanding puzzle, which I don't think we have a great answer to, but the Romans and the Greeks had a lot of, had amazing technological know-how in many, many respects, but many of the things they used it for seemed to just be for toys. So early steam engines in Hero of Alexandria, they used basically to move things in temples. They're gimmicks. So why are they not using it for industrial purposes or profit-making purposes? You can tell a cultural story for why that is. You can tell a story where slave labor is sufficiently cheap that mechanization is not appealing. You could tell a story where the engineer, the know. I think the tool making was there. So if you look at the Anchor Fire mechanism, this proto computer calculating device, which was discovered in a shipwreck and was in off a Greek island, Anchor mechanism, they had the engineering tools to do it. And so that even makes a positive. I used to think they didn't have the engineering capabilities, like the ability to make, you know, reliable clocks and so on. They had it undoubtedly now. So that makes a puzzle more stark. And I don't have a great answer to it, but I think culture is plausible. And I think the slavery factor is also plausible. And then when it comes to the Dutch, so they are participants in the scientific revolution. One thing they seem to... So I would mostly say it's a scale thing. And I think part of it's a political economy story in that the Dutch are just too affected by their war with France, too devastated by their war with France. But they've got this huge tax burden, huge debt burden they have to pay off throughout the 18th century. And it leads to a bit of being this stagnant, relatively stagnant at high levels of income, 18th century. But you could also say that Amsterdam's a finance capital, a trade and finance capital. It doesn't seem to have quite the population of skilled mechanics and manufacturers that you see in British cities, particularly obviously Birmingham, and then later Manchester and Liverpool. And so that could be another factor, but there's not as tight a link as we see in England between the scientists and the people actually improving things on the ground and making machines.
That makes a lot of sense. And I wanted to touch on two things which don't appear so much in the book, and maybe because it's slightly later. But I was reading what Brad DeLong has written, and two things that he mentions quite strongly in his kind of more grand narrative, so you've kind of put a lot of things together, is the rise of the kind of corporate form and also the rise of the industrial lab. Although I guess industrial lab is putting science into action. So in that way, it's just perhaps a slightly later on view. Do you think that perhaps he dates it from 1870. So maybe from 1870 onwards did play this kind of role in the sustaining part of the industrial revolution? And do you think maybe there's a little bit more weight on those?
It's part of a second, what people call the second industrial revolution. So it is a core part of that. And it's the second industrial revolution we've seen some of the most decisive technological innovations. And so in some sense, the industrial revolution traditionally, and we go with the traditional view, gets weighted very heavily because it's the first. And it is a breakthrough. But it's true that the decisive improvement in living standards and additionally, the period where, like, in some sense, the modern world is created is the second industrial revolution. So that's when you get, you know, as DeLong and others have mentioned, that's when you get, you know, electricity, it's when you get the automobile. So, you know, the really core technologies for the modern world come about in the second industrial revolution. Now, I'm reading Brad DeLong's latest book right now. And so, you know, he emphasizes the corporate form more than we do. We do mention it at some point because it's linked to North Wallace Weingast, but I also think it's very important. I think it is important. It's just he emphasizes it because it allows a division of labor. So now you could be a Tesla in a corporation, and you don't have to worry about the management side effects. So I can buy that that's important. Whether or not it's critical, it doesn't strike me as being as critical as maybe as DeLong maybe suggests. The research lab is definitely important, but I think they were already bringing, technology was already being brought to the market before the research lab. So whether or not that's like as decisive or just a part of this overall process of making innovation profitable is debatable. But I don't have a problem with emphasizing them. I think it's just a matter of emphasis.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense. Maybe we can argue a tiny bit or delve into this corporate form thing, because I guess some people put a lot of weight on that, you know, the British East India or maybe the Dutch East India and this corporate form. And I think it is interesting that the world now is, you know, very much this kind of corporate form that you have. The other observation I have is really on what some cultures or country, and we can be slightly careful about how we talk about culture because we don't kind of mean it in any sort of dismissive way. But I think of this as a kind of view of credit or the corporate form within some Islamic way of thinking, because actually even to today, the securitization of assets and how they deal with credit is a little bit difficult in terms of that kind of securitization. So I do wonder whether maybe there is something more to that corporate form, or whether that maybe just kind of as an emergence from this idea that you had a saying in the first one about institutions. So you simply needed some sets of institutions to carry forward these ideas. And actually the corporate form was that, but really it's just a kind of extension of institutional thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly, like, some scholars have emphasized it more than we have. As I say, Naomi Lamro and Jean Laurent Rosenthal, it's emphasizing this development of a corporate form. It is a decisive thing in the 19th century. And it's just, I feel so it's important for risk sharing, and it's important, I guess, for innovation. And it does matter for making, for North Wallace Weingarts emphasized the idea that you have long-lived organizations which are separate from the state. Mm-hmm. And I think that is important. It's just, we see it as, I think, because we focus a bit more on the Industrial Revolution than on the Second Industrial Revolution. And we focus a little bit more on what developments in Britain and Europe and on America, that we're a little bit less kind of, this is the key innovation. But yeah, I definitely think it's important. Credit's important, banks are important. I just don't think they're the decisive thing. I think by the time you get corporate form, the modern corporate form, the genie of economic growth is, in my view, already out of the bottle. So that's why I'm not emphasizing it as much as perhaps others do.
Yeah, well, that's good to know. Well, I think you might be right and DeLong might be wrong, but obviously still not necessarily a settled debate. And I guess this is one of the other things you don't, you sort of mention in passing, but don't put as much weight on. And actually, I haven't seen too many, but I do wonder about the role of the creation of markets for intangibles at the time. You particularly see this in patents. And you see this kind of strangely, because actually where you have certain companies formed today, seem to depend on patents and patent laws. And in some ways, I do view this as an extension of institutions, and you always had trade secrets and those sort of things. And you mentioned it as one of probably those as a factor, but again, not a decisive factor. But I wonder, because there's so much emphasis on intangibles today, whether it is actually one of those foundational aspects which actually, if we didn't have, it might have been very hard for us to sustain. Very hard to know about the counterfactual, but I was interested in whether you thought more about the role of either patents or the institutions around intangible ideas and copyright and the like.
The literature on in economic history has tended to be a bit down on the role of patents in the Industrial Revolution per se. So that's kind of, and that's what we follow. So, you know, a lot of important innovations in the Industrial Revolution were not patented. And then some of there's a debate, I don't take a strong view on this, but there's a debate about James Watt's patent on the steam engine. Did it block subsequent invention or did it not block it? People have made strong claims that it blocked it. Others, I think George Selgin, argue that it didn't necessarily block it. So there's a debate on patents in the Industrial Revolution itself, which I think, even if it's not fully settled, doesn't point towards patents playing a particularly decisive role. Nonetheless, patents could still have mattered later as we go into the 19th century. So people are innovating for a bunch of reasons in the 18th century and the 19th century, and obtaining a patent for innovation is only one and potentially a minor reason for it. Now, going to the 19th century and early 20th century, you need some way to protect, you need some monopoly rent to reward innovation. And so, but can trade secrets do as well as patents? For some things, right? Coca-Cola still have a, you know, have kept their recipe secret. I think patents are not decisive or that important in the Industrial Revolution. Now, did they make a positive contribution towards innovation in the later 19th century, early 20th century? I believe a case could be made for it, but I'm not more expert than that.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. So the median literature downplays it certainly in the first Industrial Revolution, but 1870 onwards and sustaining might have had a bigger role. Another thing I picked up on in your book, and I hadn't really seen the literature on it, so I was really interested, which was this idea, I'm going to put it in my language, but this kind of idea of nation states which had come through perhaps a common law route or a sort of living constitution route, which you see in the UK, versus those nations which had more of a kind of fixed constitution and fixed laws and how they might relate to progress. In fact, I see this debate a little bit in the US today, actually everywhere, but in the US today, between a kind of more literal reading of old constitution law and more of a kind of progressive reading and more of a living constitution. But it seems to me there's some literature which is maybe suggestive that if your representative democracy had a little bit more of this flex, it made it a little bit easier to sustain their initial catalyst. Have I read that right? And is it maybe just a little factor, or is it potentially more important? And how does this extend to other nation states?
I think it's a little bit of tension here between, so there's a literature about common law versus Roman civil law, which we review. But that's not so much about fixed constitutions versus variable constitutions, because on that divide, right, the US and UK both come down as being common law. And so there's this literature arguing for benefits of common law over particularly French legal traditions. And so that, because Hayek made that insight, and then there's this more recent, though now 20, 30 year old, kind of econometric empirical literature arguing for some benefits. That literature is quite heavily criticized, particularly by economic historians. So I don't want to put too much weight on it in the sense that there do seem to be some particular benefits for how financial markets might have developed better when you have common law just seems to protect shareholders better and things like that. But one weakness of that literature, I think, is they really emphasize legal origins. And what's happened in the last kind of 30 years is that there's actually been a lot of amalgamation of law. So England's a common law country, but when it was part of the European Union, Britain's a common law country, but when it was part of the European Union, they actually imported in a lot of continental civil law. And similarly, other countries, so you know, in sub-Saharan Africa, you have countries with French civil law due to their colonial origins, and countries with English common law due to their colonial origins. But over time, they're just taking law from each other. And so the differences are shrinking. So there's a literature on that. Now, how that relates to fixed constitutions versus living constitutions, I actually haven't seen explored in the academic research. In general, my view is most countries follow the US. Like a lot of like new countries or fresh democracies want to have a formal constitution. So I think Britain is almost on its own. It's quite rare in its living constitution. I mean, the power of a monarchy de jure is far, far greater than anyone realizes, because we don't exercise any of those powers.
Yeah, okay, that's clear. So the common law arguments seem relatively weak, although there is a literature on it. Property rights, obviously important, but not necessarily common law. And then, yeah, the UK is a little bit odd in terms of its living constitution and actually still has ramifications now. So I know First Nations tribes and Aboriginal tribes in Australia and Canada are pulling out contracts that they made with the monarchy going back. Mm. And there's some arguments around that, which actually potentially have legal force. So that is quite interesting. I guess that pivots me to another element you talk about and put sort of some weight on, although it's a bit complicated, around, I guess, this kind of elements of culture. I'm particularly interested in what you make of trust, because that kind of comes up a lot, you know, this ability to trust. And I guess there's two or three things here. One is, did you only have view on the kind of Quaker movement and this kind of handshake trust element? And was that important or not? And then you touch on it briefly, the kind of so-called frontier culture in the US, or perhaps that's like the building movement today. But I'm not sure whether that's just a nice story or if there is something more to it. But it does have something which actually, again, Anton Holz has called about this kind of innovation mindset, or, you know, people who kind of tinkered, or entrepreneurs around about particularly this first industrial revolution, but maybe the second as well, and all of those kind of things together going, making, call it elements of culture or a kind of mindset. And I was interested to know how much weight you put on that and what your view is. And some of the literature is obviously a bit mixed.
Yeah, so a lot of my questions. So the way we view culture is through this language that Joe Heinrich has pioneered, but it goes back to Hayek actually, which is to see culture as a set of heuristics. So in a complex world, we rely on heuristics, and these heuristics we've learned from others, even from our parents or from our peers. And we're not fully rationalized. We can't fully rationalize. So who we trust is one of those things. It's like, you know, like some people be more trusting than others. If you grew up in a more trusting society, you're probably going to trust more. And so all else equal, high levels of trust are going to be good for an economy because they're going to just allow you to do things quicker. It's like, you know, I'm going to assume you're going to pay me for some service. I'm just going to, you know, we're not going to like do everything as a spot exchange. We're not going to, you know, we're going to just assume that other people are going to play by the rules, and that actually lowers a lot of transaction costs. But of course, trust is endogenous, right? In an economy which is doing well, people are more likely to behave in a trustworthy manner. So there's a big econometric problem in disentangling causality. So trust is one example of a cultural trait, and cultural traits we think of as these have learned heuristics. Now, so in a low trust environment, it could be in equilibrium. So if you're in a society where crime is rife, people are dishonest, you're going to be suspicious of people, and your suspicion of people is going to make other people suspicious of you, and it's going to be self-reinforcing. And so, that's a barrier to economic development and economic growth. In a British story, there does seem to be a role for religious minorities, so particularly Quakers, in the Industrial Revolution. And so people said, why was that? Like, what gave them that advantage? And there is a story where trust did give them an edge in terms of expanding their businesses. So there are a lot of Quaker businesses in Industrial Revolution Britain. But I think it's plausible. There's no econometric paper which nails this, but John McKeon has written about it, so I think it's plausible. Whether it's decisive is another matter, as we've already mentioned. That's quite different to the frontier culture that Americans are said to have, which is all about individualism, about going it alone, and actually might have some potentially negative correlates. So I think the scholars who did the frontier paper show that in these counties with more frontier people, there's lower take up of vaccines, for example. So cultural traits persist for long periods of time and they shape economic outcomes. So mindsets matter. So Anton's stuff on innovation. Yeah, innovation does seem to be a cultural element, I think, to innovation for sure. And if a lot of your peers are innovating, you're more likely to innovate. If everyone you know takes very kind of low risk jobs and doesn't push the boundary out, then that's your incentive as well. So I do think innovation matters. A culture matters for innovation for sure. It's hard. It's not something you can pull a policy lever and just fix by by lowering the interest rate. It's something which it's hard to see on the ground, but it matters.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so, like you say, if trust is that foundational element, maybe you could argue in the frontier culture, if you're going it alone, you maybe have less trust, there's less of a community. Arguably, we could see, and what you say about Quakers, and then the heuristics, you kind of do what everyone else is doing. So if people are innovating in that mindset. I think the Quaker piece is interesting because some of the stuff I've read suggests that they were kind of foundational in elements such as the end of slavery. Within that.
Yeah.
And I was kind of interested in some of your views about where social and moral progress may or may not fit in here, because and maybe we can reiterate it again. Your reading of the literature is that slavery was actually quite small and probably didn't have such a huge role in terms of Industrial Revolution. But I'm thinking if you've got slavery, if you think about maybe women's votes or women entering the work world more, maybe more modern day times, you've got minority rights and things. So if we think about where we have a moral and social progress. Does it run separately or does it interact? I mean, it obviously kind of helps some way and it's probably got this complicated interaction. I'm not sure you can necessarily say which one comes first or they influence one another, but has anyone tried to kind of look at this and has come up with anything which can actually be reasonably substantiated? Or I find it's probably quite a hard thing to know either the counterfactual or have the data.
It's very hard. No one's been able to do it yet. It's an interesting question. So I think in my book on religious toleration, and economists, like most economists, will tend to push more materialistic views of these things than non-economists. I think, although not actually, I'll caveat that. But the very materialistic view about this is that when you're starving and you're poor, the network, the circle of people who you can really care about is also pretty small. So if you're poor in medieval Europe, you're going to care about your immediate family and your neighbors and people in your village, and you're not going to really care about people being enslaved in other parts of the world or other areas. And indeed, in England in the early modern period, people's moral circle was smaller. And so the fact that slavery was atrocious and abominable, but it was happening in the Americas, it was happening in the Caribbean islands, and we're not seeing it, made it seem less bad to British at least. And so it did. So one view, the materialist view would be to say like it's only when you get rich enough, you get some surplus income, and you're no longer thinking about where your next meal is coming from, then you have the resources to think about wider moral issues. So that's a very materialistic view, which is to say, first you need some economic growth to get going, and then as you get richer, you're going to care more about people who are not in your immediate circle. That materialistic view, I think, is largely to a high, large degree quite true, but it's also missing a lot of things as well. And it's missing the cultural story. So the cultural story would say that probably something like Christianity is at the root of this, because Christianity does teach a particular moral code, but then it had to be implemented by groups who were fairly radical and willing to go against the conventional wisdom. So because Christianity emerged in a world where slavery was just ubiquitous and inevitable, early church fathers reconciled themselves to the existence of slavery, even though it goes against the idea that, you know, people are equal and they all have a soul. So it took a group like the Quakers to really think that this was an abominable, and they were far out from mainstream Protestants and Catholics in all their views. They're pacifists, they believe in religious freedom, they're willing to kind of be ostracized and punished for this. So the Quakers are important in this moral revolution that happens in the 18th and 19th centuries. And then they managed to convey their revolutionary fervor to other people, both religious and secular, in a way that generates the abolition movement. And it's fascinating. And it's clearly the materialistic story I gave you isn't sufficient. It's part of the story, but it doesn't quite capture what's going on with abolitionism.
I
think it helps that the people in the South, they can't become abolitionists it's harder for them to be abolitionists in the following sense. They grow up with slavery. Say the South of the US, the Confederate States, they grow up with slavery. And so they even when they know about all the crimes of it and all the horrific things, they can't judge their friends and family who are slave owners too harshly. It's hard for them to do so. Morally, you know, if your dad and mum own slaves and so does your cousin, even if you don't think slavery is a good idea, it's a bad institution, it's hard for you to accept the worldview which says that your parents are criminals. So it's easier for the Northerners and for the British who live in Britain and to think of the slave owners in the Caribbean or the slave owners in Virginia evil, and to develop that set of views against slavery. So and then they can convince other people. So I think it's a fascinating topic, but it's not one that economists are best placed to solve, because we it's going to be difficult to track the change in cultural values. Maybe there's a way to do it looking at abolitionist newspapers or looking at using text search. Maybe someone could scan, you know, thousands of documents and see how abolitionist sentiment arises over time and where it arises.
that's one for the PhD, possible PhD or postdoc students out there. Yeah, I can see that. So these qualities, cultural qualities, hard to measure, hard to get a sense of, and therefore falls out of a lot of economics today. But I do hear you on your narrative of saying, well, you need to have a certain level of richness maybe as a prerequisite, but then you also need some cultural change story, maybe by a minority or wherever it comes from. So like, you know, you had richer nations before, they haven't maybe had a prerequisite, but you need that narrative as well. That has maybe made me to reflect, if you fast forward to today, and I think particularly maybe around climate and those externalities, and maybe around about inequality as well, if those lessons still hold, it seems to me that you would then need nations to become extremely rich, everyone to be as rich as possible, and then also need a narrative about how important that might be. And actually, that kind of maybe sort of fits today. You have got some people with that narrative, but you also have, you know, innovation and say the techno-optimists or realists saying like, no, we need to be wealthy, or we will be wealthier to handle this. So it kind of even fits today. I don't know what you had any thoughts about the climate piece, or maybe the inequality piece, about fast forwarding that, because obviously it wasn't such an issue a few hundred years ago.
Yeah, I think it works with climate change. You need some level of moral universalism, but you can see, I mean, people in rich countries care about climate change, and they are willing to pay a price. Not one thing, people don't want to pay a price if they think they're the only ones paying it. So that's why it's hard to cut down your own emissions without too much, if you don't think everyone is also sacrificing. But people in rich countries are willing to pay through taxes. They're willing to accept that, and that reflects moral universalism and the fact they're rich. But it's much harder to persuade people in poorer countries to sacrifice economic growth to reduce their emissions. So that's certainly the case. I think inequality is a little bit of a different story. So I'll leave it there. I think it's a little different to. I kind of think it's got different motivations, I think, than a quite big moral universalism, which motivates concern about the slave trade, concern about, say, genocide in other countries, or concern about, you know, climatic catastrophes.
Sure. Okay, that makes sense. And maybe skipping back one thing on going back to the history part. I read your book as kind of suggesting that the role of war was maybe via second order impacts on technology and the like, rather than war in itself in terms of its contribution to economic growth and technology and things. Do I read that right? And, you know, what is your thoughts about all of the wars that we used to have?
So I think there's a bit of a naive, well, there's a view where war is good for economic growth, and I think that's wrong, mostly, because war is very destructive. We're seeing that in Ukraine right now. So, I think some of that comes from this misplacing Keynesian notion that war kind of gets the economy productive, revved up, which is just kind of like, I think, bad Keynesianism. And then it also comes from the fact that in the 20th century, there have been important spillovers from particularly American military innovation has spilled over to the domestic sector. And so that's true, there have been spillovers. But I'm not aware of such spillovers from the pre-industrial period. So on net, war is probably bad. But then there's this argument that war is weeding out weaker states, or war is encouraging urbanization, or war is prompting in some sense some change, which is good for growth. On net, the destructive effects of war are probably the more important ones. But of course, without the pressure of war, you wouldn't get a lot of institutional changes that we talk about. So that's where war comes in. You're weeding out weaker policies, and that is a proving ground for certain institutions. So that's what happens in Britain. Like the Glorious Revolution, all these institutions are really driven by competition with other powers, particularly France.
Yeah, and maybe helps drive representative democracy and all of these other impacts. Yeah, I can see that. So war itself. So if you had another mechanism which could achieve the same ends, you'd definitely want to choose that over war. And maybe is that also going back to some of your earlier work on the Black Death? Because obviously that's simply like a bad thing happens, and maybe you get these short run impacts, but maybe the second order on in institutions. I mean, maybe what do you find was most misunderstood, or you find most surprising on your work on the Black Death? And I guess you made the Black Death able to be a kind of one of these kind of discontinuity type of semi-causal type of experiments. What did you find there?
Yeah, so the main story about the Black Death is obviously, you know, 40% of the population die, so you massively change the labor capital land ratios, and so I don't know if we're revolutionizing our understanding of the Black Death. More is clarifying. So you could take what I would call crude Malthusian view, where the Black Death is just great. This is kind of the view Greg Clark promotes in his book, A Farewell to Arms. Black Death is great. You know, real wages soar, peasants get to eat meat, and it's all great, which is kind of strange given that, you know, if you care about living standards in general, you care about your life expectancy, you care about the life expectancy of your friends and family. So this elevation of a death rate was probably pretty horrible for overall living quality, even if your incomes and wages go up. And the increase in wages was actually took some time to take place. And it was to some partially offset by disintermediation in the overall economy, so decline in trade and so on. But it's still true. It's still true that wages did go up. It's just they took several decades to do so. So it wasn't like an instant adjustment. Wages did go up, and it did eventually produce something of a golden age for those workers who survive. So I don't think there we're overturning the kind of, you know, the caricature of a Black Death as much as clarifying it. But for example, it was the 1370s. It took until the 1370s for real wages to really start rising in England. Is the Black Death a watershed moment? I have to admit, I'm still unsure about this after all this research on it. There are scholars who argue that the origins of both the great divergence between Europe and Asia and the little divergence within Europe can be traced to the Black Death. And we discuss those arguments, but I'm not sure if I really fully endorse them. We have a paper under review right now looking at the impact of city growth on the Black Death, and we don't find evidence for a total reset of European economy. So that's a bit of a partial answer, but that's what I feel about it currently.
Yeah, okay, so not the be all and end all. And I guess this refers to also some of your stuff on geography. It's definitely a factor, but it's certainly not the be all and end all. And you can see this with various geographic things. Okay, well, I thought we'd maybe do a short section on overrated and underrated if you're game, and then end with a couple of questions. So you can do a quick answer, or you can pass or make some comments. We just got three or four. So overrated or underrated, GDP as a measure?
I think underrated now. The HDI or the other measures just correlate with GDP very well. And so, you know, with a few exceptions, like you have Gulf states, which are very unequal and do bad on some of other aspects. But yeah, basically GDP is good, growth is good. All the criticisms and caveats that people have, they're not that important relative to the overall message. But GDP good is good, growth is good, and ordinary people underrate how good it is.
That seems fair. And I guess that probably means you underweight maybe natural capital and happiness research, as then actually just correlates with GDP.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Great. Carbon tax or carbon pricing?
I think it's underrated because it's seen as a political economy, like no-go area, especially in the US. It seems like attempts to carbon tax failed. I tend to think that a lot of the policy mistakes of the last 20 years, this goes for housing as well, have been maybe due to politicians failing to lead in a way that maybe they could have done. And I'm not an expert on politics, I'm intentionally naive on this, but I kind of think that sometimes the politicians are too deferential to the electorate, and they're too deferential to the media. So they're too deferential to the UK, to the BBC. and to the BBC phrase thing. So getting on to current politics, I guess now, it's like the current, I think it's refreshing to have government policy where they're just like, no, like, this is what we think. Now, we could be wrong and it could be disastrous. This is what we think. You've elected us. This is what we're going to do in some sense. And so I think carbon taxes should just have been, I think that you should have had politicians brave enough to, after, you know, campaign on them, run on them in their, as in their elections, and say we're going to implement a carbon tax and we're going to make it revenue neutral. So we're going to cut other tax, we're going to cut income tax and charge carbon taxes. And it's just, they don't poll well. People don't like the idea of paying more for energy or more for petrol or gasoline, so they don't get implemented. And in the US, they're seen as like, you know, this neoliberal elitist policy. So both Republicans hate them, and then, like, you know, Bernie Sanders, Democrats hate them. So that's why there's a coalition against them. But I feel that politicians need to listen to experts more, and they need to trust experts and risk their political careers. This is a bit of a tangent away from the carbon tax specifically, and away from history. But if you look at, I mean, American politics is a little bit different, so I won't comment on that. But if you look at British politicians, they have very short shelf lives. So David Cameron and George Osborne are relatively, you're not old, they're young, relatively, and they've been out of office now for like 6-7 years, and it doesn't look like either of them will ever get a political comeback. So we're not in the age of like political comebacks. Tony Blair, like, you know, had an amazing opportunity and did a lot and reformed many things. We didn't reform nearly as much as he wanted to. He was out of office when he was in his early 50s, I believe, and, like, you know, no political comeback for him. So Rishi Sunak, you know, again, super young, may not ever come back into headline politics. So if you have a current chancellor or prime minister, in some sense, if you really genuinely believe your policies are best for the country, you might as well implement them. You might get, if they don't work, or if you get punished at the polls and you lose the election, in some sense, so what? Your shelf life is short anyway, if you look at all our recent political leaders. None of them have come back in frontline politics, unlike in the age of Gladstone and Disraeli, or in the age of...
Yeah, there's a part of me which agrees, because particularly in the UK, we don't have midterms. So you have your 4 or 5 years, probably that's it. You might as well do it. And yeah, my two big things would be carbon tax and actually building on the green belt, which is, it shouldn't even be called the green belt. It's mostly brown belt. So, and that's because there's relatively few things that actually you can get 80 to 90% of economists to agree upon. Actually, we talked a little bit about this in history, right? There's always balance and nuance. But, you know, in the UK, or, you know, 80 to 90% of economists agree on a carbon tax and actually give the revenue back some way, either dividend or a tax cut, so you can make it revenue neutral. And actually, most people agree on that a lot of the green belt is really useless and you should build houses on it. So when your technocrats have that degree of consensus, you should probably listen to them. Other things, obviously, is a bit more 50-50, but that's kind of fine. Okay, a last couple on here then. So thinking about innovation then, do you like these innovation institutions like DARPA? Here in the UK, we have ARIA, you've got HARPA and things like that. Overrated or underrated?
I think I have to pass on that one because I don't know enough about them. So
sure, that's fine. We'll pass. And then current governance mechanisms. So current mechanisms of representative democracy, let's maybe just say UK or US. Do you think they're about right or overrated or underrated?
Overrated. Yeah, so we there's obviously something obviously is a bit broken in the system right now in both US, UK in different ways. So I mean, I touched on it earlier. I think that I think we can in both countries on different margins there have been major policy failures in the last 2 decades, and particularly potentially, I guess, the last 2 decades, like ex post, like at the time, I'm not saying I was smarter than anyone else. I'm not saying I would have made better decisions than anyone in office, but ex post, we can say there have been major governance failures. So I think we have to think about how how these work. I mean, one example, which is kind of just obvious, and I think everyone kind of agrees with, though we don't know what the solution is that politicians, it's really hard to be a politician, particularly it seems like British MP in the age of social media, right? You get a lot of hate mail, you get a lot of you get really hassled by crazy people. And so that means so if you're a British MP, you don't want to build on a green belt if your constituents are in a green belt, and like they can make your life hell if you do something they don't want you to do. And so there does seem to be an issue with how our democracies are functioning in terms of delivering good policies. Now, I don't have a solution for how to improve it, but I think people should be willing to think about it. I don't know, people will differ a lot on what the proposals are. I know in the UK, for example, more than 10 years ago now, there were discussions about proportional representation or the alternative vote, which may or may not have been good. I my views on that change, but I think we should be open to the idea that we don't have the best system. We could improve.
That seems fair, but you don't have any intuition about what you might experiment with.
Well, in a British case, the House of Lords is kind of pointless right now because it's purely advisory and it's purely filled with ex-politicians. And so on the face of it, you have basically a parliamentary dictatorship because Parliament gets whatever it wants. But on the other hand, there seems to be a struggle to actually get policies through. So I don't know exactly what to do there, but it seems not quite right. I think the thing I mentioned on social media, politicians are not experienced enough. They seem to leave office too quickly. There are plenty of, I thought, effective cabinet ministers from the Cameron Osborne era who basically left politics in 20 after Brexit. And then you replaced them with a bunch of people who were Boris Johnson or Theresa May's, very few survivors. So I feel in a British case, compared to even the 1990s, you don't get longevity of cabinet ministers. And so and people move around so much, so they don't get expertise in their role. So there are a lot of small things I would consider.
Mm. Yeah, my radical solutions would be something to do with the upper house here in the UK, something like give them a single 10-year term or a single 10-year term with a 5-year extension. So it's longer, but kind of limited. So they kind of feel like, okay, 10 years, we can get something done, but we're only going to get those things done. But you have to be elected, right? Or some sort of thing. And the second really controversial one is, so I would slim down the number of MPs, but I would pay them a lot more. No one likes this, but I would even pay them whatever it is, like whatever you think it is to be the equivalent, like CEO of your mini state. Maybe that's even £1 million, right? So people would probably really want to do it for £1 million, but maybe like they do in Singapore, if there's any graft or any bribery, maybe you have to evoke the monarchy, right? That would be treason and you go to jail for a really, really long time. It's like unacceptable to have this second job graft thing, but we'll pay you a lot of money. And therefore, if you're a poor person or have some other radical ideas, you could, well, £1 million would be life-changing. And means that more people could go for that and hopefully you would get better talent. Maybe it's too materialistic, but I do think incentives matter and we don't pay them very well.
I do think there's a huge weird difference in the British system between your average local MP who stands up in PMQs and just says something stupid about their local constituents. They're like, my local constituents really want a park, basically. Sorry, we're going totally off topic, but I'm sorry, I'm in danger of ranting. So there's the local MPs are really fixated on local issues and have no training or expertise in what's going on at a larger scale. And they don't have access to high quality advisors or so on. So they really are quite trivial in terms of what their concerns are. And then being a cabinet minister, suddenly you get to be a cabinet minister and you're in charge of a national health service. Like, how can one person be in charge of a national health service? It's like the size of a small country, basically. And it's got so many issues, so many complexities. And so to the idea that you can go just from being an MP to that position, it seems wrong. And I think bigger constituencies, less localism might be a way forward. But I'm just totally speculating.
Well, that and on an NHS as well, they generally have neither healthcare training nor economic training nor healthcare economics trainings, which is a huge profession in itself. Okay, so last one on the overrated, underrated, universal basic income, UBI.
So I think that's overrated right now, at least by its proponents, because de facto, well, two things. Firstly, I think work is an important component of human existence. And I, on the one hand, I appreciate the idea of it. It could allow people to pursue work they're passionate about, like, you know, whether it's like podcasting or YouTubing or something like that. But I do worry that it could just support indolence. And I also think that it's de facto will not replace, you know, Milton Friedman's idea of a negative income tax was to replace all other welfare. And like really to slim down all other programs and replace it with something like a UBC, UBI. And I think in principle, that would be potentially an improvement. But in practice, it's not going to be like that. It's going to be another form of welfare. And I just wouldn't focus on it, basically.
That makes sense. Would you prefer a universal basic infrastructure? That's something that Diane Coyle, who's also been on the podcast, has mentioned. Or maybe more controversially, I hear sometimes a kind of job guarantee system. I have no idea how that would work. But to get around this problem about actually jobs do mean something to people.
Yeah, so I'm not too in favor of a job guarantee because I think it's too much messing with kind of market incentives. I don't know what Diane Coyle means actually by the universal right to infrastructure, but like I mean, I think that you want people to not fall below basic minimum, which is set by your society. So like you know, like it's going to be higher in a richer country than in a poorer country, and so and you don't want that to have too many disincentives to work. So in that sense, maybe some basic payment could be justified, but it would have to be small. I mean, I think the problem is there's always a trade-off between setting the incentives not to penalize people who want to work and also not penalizing people who cannot work. And so, but in some sense, you can't square the circle.
Makes sense.
But I think the current UK welfare reform seems to be in the right direction. I know they're unpopular, but I can't remember what they're called, but which are trying to minimize the negative tax incentives you face from going from welfare to work. I think that's important to any scheme.
Yeah, it is a universal benefit. I think Diane Coyle meant by infrastructure, essentially very good public services. So rather than give people income, you're giving people sort of a more equal opportunity to them, but it's that sort of concept. Great. So final two questions. One is, are there any current projects you're working on you'd like to share or anything we haven't mentioned that you'd want to highlight?
Well, I've got a Templeton grant with Desiree Desir, so that's my wife, and we're working on the origins of liberal institutions in England with not just us, with several graduate students at GNU as well. And so that's a big project, but it won't come to fruition for several years because it's really in the data collection stage. So that's kind of the first thing comes to mind. And I've got some other projects on things we've touched on, like the Black Death, but this one on liberal institutions, basically from the Norman Conquest, Magna Carta, all the way up to a Glorious Revolution. So it's very historical, but it's going to be more data intensive than anyone's done on all those topics, I think. So it's quite ambitious. That's the big project.
Oh, that sounds really exciting. I was recently speaking to Jake Soll, and he put a lot of weight on thinkers thinking about Cicero influencing these institutions. But anyway, seems to be
It's more history of ideas way of thinking about it. Yeah, people have asked us if we're going to integrate it with a history of ideas. And in principle, I'm open to that. I like reading about Cicero and so on, but it's not something even though I like that stuff, my research tends to be more on the material side of things.
You like the data. Yeah. Something you can add. Great. And then last question, do you have any life advice you'd like to share, or maybe you could have an advice for a policymaker for one policy, although it sounds like your policy is carbon tax, so maybe we discuss that, or maybe advice for other people who are interested in becoming an economic scholar and the route you've taken. So any career or life advice you want to share?
I'm not sure I'm the best person to give advice. So I don't have a huge role. It's easy in that we've got amazing resources online, so you know, podcasts, Everything is online, basically. So the young person who's like ambitious and interested can actually get to speed quickly. So you can teach yourself econometrics by watching tons of YouTube videos. Like most people won't, right? Because there's other stuff to watch on YouTube. There's other stuff to do. You know, I could be teaching myself foreign languages on YouTube, and I'm not doing it because my opportunity cost, I guess, is maybe high. But if you're young and wanted to study this stuff, you can get a huge head start just by using the internet cleverly. And you have to work out how. I mean, Tyler Cowen's advice is, you know, find the right mentors, find some people, and kind of like learn from them. But you could do a huge amount early on to give yourself a head start before you go to university. Because to be honest, you know, like the university experience isn't necessarily going to be all that great. It depends where you go, but like it could be, you know, you don't know what you'll get into and you'll be distracted by other things. So I would start early and try and learn as much as possible on your own. And then you can be ready for your PhD program by the time you're an undergrad.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So basically use YouTube and the internet very well. Did Tyler interview you coming through? Did you have a classic difficult Tyler question?
He interviewed me for my job, this job, but a long time ago now. His questions, I don't know, I can't remember exactly how I did. He asked some good questions, yeah, of course.
Nothing really tricky that you remember to this day?
I mean, one of his questions was, "What's the most important like thing in economic history?" And then why? And then when I said what it was, and it wasn't exactly what I was working on, why aren't you working on it?
Oh, that's tough. And he said, "Well, now I've written a book, so
now I mean, I just said I was. I basically my answer was just, but what I was working on indirectly shed light on this really important thing, even if it wasn't it." I can't remember all the others, but he obviously asks sharp questions, although they're slightly different, I think, the ones he asked in those days to the ones he asks now.
And do you still think it's the same, the most important thing in economic history today?
Yeah, I basically said like this, the question of this book, the origins of economic growth, and you've written a book on it.
I do think maybe you should extend it slightly into thinking about what the lessons might be for today, but I guess that's for the forecasters to think. But I think it's really intriguing because the way you put it all together, and it has made me think about some of these things that if you go back to some of the historical roots, that maybe some of them you could just do more of, or maybe radically more of, and we should try that. So I heartily recommend everyone listening to get a hold of the copy of the book, available from internet and all good bookstores and the like. And Mark, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks, Ben. Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
If you appreciate the show, please like and subscribe, as it helps others find the podcast.